Hello everyone, Neil Patel here. Thank you for downloading the latest episode of the Indian Startup Show. So today I chat to Suresh Shankar. He's the co-founder of Crayon Data. Crayon Data enables consumers to make more satisfying choices and helps traditional enterprises engage their customers. In this podcast, we talk about how we got started, how the actual platform works, the roller coaster ride as an entrepreneur, how big they actually want to go with this, what's left to achieve. We also talk about climbing mountains, writing a book, and a very interesting story about a Chinese bamboo tree, and much, much more. So please enjoy the show. Thank you. Hello, Suresh. Thanks for coming on the Indian Startup Show today.
Hi, Neil. Great to be on the show.
Excellent. Please tell me what you're building.
Okay. I am the founder of Crayon Data. It's an AI startup based in Singapore that wants to simplify the world's choices. Yep. So what we're building is a unique choice engine that understands your taste at an extremely personal level and tries to essentially bring together a simplified set of four or five relevant choices for you at any given point of time in your lifestyle.
Excellent. And where did you get the idea from?
Well, Crayon is my second startup. My first was an analytics company called Red Pill. Mm-hmm. It is an extremely pioneering firm in the analytics space. We used to do a lot of work in B2B analytics for banks, telcos, and retail and emerging markets. Mm-hmm. IBM acquired us, Red Pill, in 2009. I spent a couple of years there as the global analytics leader. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that struck me as I was working out there and when I got out to set up Crayon in 2012 is that, that today, while the world is awash with data and information, in some ways this information and data is actually making life harder for us rather than easier for us, because where earlier I had two or three bits of information and I could make a decision easily, now I have so much information coming at me that, by the time my mind can actually process all of this, understand all of that, there are so many contradictory pieces that in a funny way, it's actually become harder. And all my life, I worked in the area of helping enterprises understand their consumers and how to market to them and understand their consumers' attitudes and behavior. And one thing that struck me is that actually the process of choosing is actually becoming more and more of a misery, while choice itself is magical. Mm-hmm. And that's really what we said. I said, there's really a big problem out here that needs to be solved. So that led me to set up Crayon in 2012.
Excellent. So is this for all industries or is it for specific industries, would you say?
So Crayon basically works in what we call the lifestyle economy. So what we help people do is to understand choices that consumers make in lifestyle categories like dining, shopping, travel, choosing hotels and destinations, etc. Mm-hmm. So largely, I think what we cater to, the companies that we work with are companies that that cater to consumers in this field. So we work with credit card companies, we work with airlines and hotels. So essentially in these kind of and retail sector, etc. So these are the kind of companies that we work with today.
Mm-hmm. And how's it going so far? Can you share some stats perhaps?
Well, it's a startup, and as, like with all startups, the idea is always great. We all think we'll conquer the world, and then we learn a few things as we go along. And as you go along, you kind of realize you've got to do a few course corrections. You do a few pivots, and so all in all, I'd say we are for a four-year-old startup, we're doing pretty well. Mm-hmm. We'd like to have been much further along, and in certain views, we probably not lived up to the promise that we had. So it's what, I would call the exact, it's what the Buddha would have called the middle path. We are roughly, roughly where I guess a four-year-old startup should be. Mm-hmm. We work today with some of the world's top brands globally in the banking sector. We work with Citibank. We work with Emirates National Bank of Dubai, with Mushrook, with Australia New Zealand Bank, ANZ. Mm-hmm. We work with HDFC Bank in India. We've got a big pipeline coming up. We also work with some of the leading airline and hotel companies, Emirates Airlines, Caesars Palace in Las Vegas, etc. So as a company, I think, if you look at our logo list, it's pretty, top tier. We probably, on behalf of these companies, process anywhere between 10 to 20 million customers every month. Mm-hmm. So again, not too bad. Is that where I'd like it to be? Is that no? I'd have loved it to be, 10 times the size right now. Mm-hmm. But that startup world, you're learning as you go along and you're making some course corrections, and we've had our fair share of mistakes. But I reckon we're in a pretty good place for takeoff over the next two or three years.
Sounds exciting. You said it was 4 years old. What were the early days like? How long did it take you to get your first customers?
Well, we were a bit lucky because it's my second startup. It's my co-founder's third startup. We've had three exits between us. So I think we didn't have a problem getting clients. Mm-hmm. But what we did discover is that the AI engine that we were building, what we call a choice engine, was a little bit advanced and probably a little bit too far ahead of time in the early days. Mm-hmm. So when we went in and talked to clients, everybody would say, wow, you can do that. And then it would take a long time to essentially close the sales. And even if we close the sale, it would take a long time for them to actually implement a really different innovative solution. And one of the things we realized in that journey was that sometimes you don't want to be too far ahead of the market. Mm-hmm. So I think we also spent a fair bit of time dialing down the innovation quotient and trying to solve some of the problems that the enterprises that we serve have today, even as we are trying to keep our differentiation in terms of what's cutting edge in the technology. But interestingly, last year, Gartner, you know, we work in an area that's called digital personalization. So what we do is when we go to the enterprise, Neil, we essentially help the enterprise personalize the entire, lifestyle experience for you. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And last year in August, had done a survey where they ranked us among the top 40 search engines in the world, put us in big companies, the IBMs, the Adobes, and people like that. But at that time, what they said is that this is still a market for early stage innovators and not really for the mainstream. And it would take 2 years for it to become adopted by most companies in the world. Mm-hmm. And certainly in 2017, we're beginning to see that more and more people are realizing that unless they get digital, unless they're able to get completely personal with their customers, unless, you know, every bank needs to understand its customers as an individual, mm-hmm. and completely personalize the lifestyle experience for them. And the same goes for a hotel and an airline. And that's something that we struggled a bit to convince people on the first few years. Now we see more and more people when we walk in saying, yeah, I need that and I need it now. Mm-hmm. Earlier it was, I need it, but should I do it now? Mm-hmm. Or is this a nice to have? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of moving into the must have category, and some of it is just time.
Mm-hmm. And how big is the team now?
We have about a 70 people team. We have a development center, largely in Chennai in India. Mm-hmm. And we have our corporate headquarters in Singapore. We have a few, product leaders and salespeople here. And we also have sales teams in New York, London, and the UAE in Dubai. So we're reasonably global, but most of the 70 members actually sit in Chennai right now as we speak.
Mm-hmm. Sounds very ambitious. I mean, how big do you want to go with this then?
Well, I'm never a great one. I've always believed that you don't actually do a startup with an exit strategy or a number in mind, but I think it's good to have a directional goal. And the reason is that, you know, the moment you have an exit strategy, then you're actually trying to not build something to last, you're trying to build something to sell. Mm-hmm. And that always means that you end up compromising your core vision. So our whole idea was, when we said we want to build this choice engine, we just said, listen, today, not that Google can't do it, but that, you know, Google really gives you a lot of information. But, you know, imagine if you're trying to find let me make this personal for you, Neil. Imagine if you're trying to find a restaurant and you come to Singapore. Mm-hmm. Again, lack of information is not your problem, right? You can always find a Google search. You'll get a million results. Mm-hmm. You can look at reviews. You'll get probably thousands of reviews. Most of them will be conflicting. You can call 10 friends on Facebook and ask them, hey, where do I go? And you'll get hundreds of recommendations. Again, they'll be deeply passionate and widely divergent. Mm-hmm. And at the end of 30 or 40 minutes, you'll know closer to finding something because you don't know exactly what's the right thing with all this mass of contradictory information. The engine that we're trying to build says, listen, it understands your taste so well that what it's able to do is to say, hey, Neil, we know you like Japanese and teppanyaki. We know that you've been on a long flight and you want some comfort food. There's something close by to your hotel, but you like quiet places. And this one's not quiet. And there's something a little bit further away, but it's a little bit quieter. And something that's more likely to be in line with your taste. So what it's doing is it's looking at your taste, it's looking at the influences on you, the current context you're in, your past behavior, mm-hmm. and it's combining them all to come back and tell you, here's something that you can, that there are four or five choices that are actually relevant to you. And it's learning from your choices as you make them. Now, for me, this is an extremely ambitious thing. You want to say how far we can go is extremely ambitious because there are, let me take the top billion people in the world. Each of us is making at least 4 or 5 such choices every day to eat, to shop, to travel somewhere, to see something, to see a movie. And it's each of those choices is taking us 30 to 45 minutes on the average. So imagine if I looked at it and told you that today the world is wasting on the average about, you know, anywhere between 50 to 100 billion minutes every day mm-hmm. on the misery of choosing, right? And really, if I could have an engine that says that for these billion people, I could show you the answer to those choices in a few minutes, you're saving a huge amount of time. So directionally for me, I mean, that's really the thing is, can we serve a billion customers with this engine? That would be where I'd like to take it. Mm-hmm. Luckily for us, we're not trying to do a B2C model. You know, trying to get a billion customers in today's world where it's dominated by Facebook and Google and Twitter and Apple and Amazon is going to be extremely hard. Mm-hmm. But the B2B2C model, I think it's a lot easier for us to get there because if I work with, let's say, the top 10 or 15 global credit card companies, probably combined among them, they'll have more than a billion customers, right? If I work with telcos, if I work with 10 telcos, they probably have 2 or 3 billion customers. The same thing goes with hotels and airlines. So what it gives us is by actually going through a B2B2C model, it allows us to actually work through the enterprise and solve the problem for more customers every day. So we're at the early stage of that journey. Like I told you, we're serving about 10, 20 million customers every month through our engine. And we hope to end the year with about 50 million in the engine. And in the first 1 million is always hard. The next 5 or 10 is like hard. Mm. The next 10 is a little bit easier. We hope to get to 50. It'll be slightly easier. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But we hope that from there to get it to 500 and a billion users, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. 500 million or a billion users is going to be a lot easier journey. So I'd like to face the ambition in terms of when will the Maya engine, we call this Maya, mm-hmm. or the magic Maya, when will Maya touch a billion customers every single month? That's really the ambition out here. Excellent. Unless, of course, somebody swallows up before we get there, which is also possible in today's world.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Let's talk about you then. What's your background? Is it a technical background or non-tech business background?
So my favorite story, Neil, is that, I ran away from statistics, mathematics, and technology all through school and college. I generally failed the subject. And this is now God's way of taking revenge on me by making me do this every single day for a living. And so, I'm not a technical guy. I did an accounting and economics degree, undergraduate degree. I did my master's in business administration. Mm-hmm. I went into sales and marketing, and then I worked in advertising and media. Mm-hmm. And for the first 15 years of my life, I largely worked in what I would call a, from 1985 to 2000, in what I call the right-brained approach to marketing, mm-hmm. which is that I did look at a few data, I would look at research and so on, but I tried to understand consumers through the lens of creativity as to how to deal with them. I looked at brands and brand appeal and so on. But somewhere along the way, I realized that marketing was becoming more and more left-brained. It was led by data and technology. And that actually led me to set up my first startup, which I told you about, which is called Red Bird in 2000, mm-hmm. which is an analytics firm. And now the more I get into it, now we're not just doing analytics. We started the analytics services. Now we're doing analytics as a product. So I'm getting deeper and deeper into technology and statistics and mathematics too. But I still don't know. I'm not a geek. I'm not a nerd. I don't understand code. What I do know is, Neil, is that I like to call myself an in-between spaces guy, which means I consider the business guy and he can, you know, when they tell me a problem, I know how to go back and talk to a programmer or a coder and say, guys, this is what we might want to do with this to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. And when the coder says, this is what I'm doing, I know how to take it and convert it into a front-end user experience or a solution that a client can understand and say, this is how I can apply it in the market. So I worked in advertising and it was the same thing, right? So it's about, connecting clients and creative people. You know, one is left brain, one is extremely right brain. Mm-hmm. So my core skill set is, I think, the ability to spot patterns and work in these in-between spaces.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So you said this is your second startup. What did you learn from your first startup?
My favorite story, Neil, is the story of the Chinese bamboo tree. And I don't know whether you heard this one. And if you haven't, I'll share it with you for the benefit of your listeners. So basically, the Chinese bamboo tree is a particularly hard tree to grow. You know, you plant it, you water it, and you fertilize it for a year. Nothing happens. You turn up, you know it's a hard tree. So you turn up in the second year, you water it and fertilize it. Nothing happens. I mean, you're a persistent guy. You turn up in the third year and you water it and you fertilize it. Nothing. Now, you know, you're about like, you're blaming, you know, the universe, your family, your friends, probably your dog, everything else, and saying why. But, you know, you say, okay, I'm going to give it one last shot, and you turn up and you water and fertilize the Chinese bamboo tree in the fourth year. Nothing. And at this point, you're absolutely about to give up, but, you know, you have what I call a stupidity gene. So you turn up and say, let me just do it a little bit longer. I wasted 4 years on it. And you water and fertilize it for the fifth year. And sometime in the fifth year, the Chinese bamboo tree sprouts and grows 90 feet in 6 weeks. 90 feet in 6 weeks. Now, the reason I share the story is that all entrepreneurship is the story of the Chinese bamboo tree. And that's something I learned. I mean, there's an added complication. You don't know whether it's the fifth year or the fourth year or the third year or the eighth year. And you don't know whether it'll be 90 feet in 6 weeks or it'll be like, you know, 20 feet in 12 weeks, right? Mm-hmm. You don't know how much it'll grow. But that story has stayed with me through my first startup and my second one, that it's persistence. It's having clarity of like your vision and like, you know, just mm-hmm. staying through as long as you can see that you're making progress. So to me, that is one of the biggest learnings from my first startup. Lots of people told me, why are you doing this? Nobody wants to do this. Nobody will buy analytics. Nobody will buy analytics in Asia, etc. But, you know, IBM hasn't bought too many companies east of Europe. And you're one of the few, I mean, companies that they have. So, I mean, that's kind of tribute to the fact that we were very early pioneers and we built a company that actually created some pioneering value. Mm-hmm. So to me, that was the reward. That was the Chinese bamboo tree growing 90 feet in 6 weeks, right? So, but it came in the ninth year. Though to be fair, the first 4 years of Crayon were barren, and then in the fifth year, we actually started to grow. Sorry, of Redpill, mm-hmm. were barren, and we started to grow. And between the fifth and the eighth year, we did pretty well, which is what led us to IBM, which is what led IBM to buy us. So to me, I think that's the main story that I would give all entrepreneurs, which is persistence. I mean, you know, you got to know what you're doing. You got to have faith in your own story. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't have faith in your story, there's no reason for the people who work with you to have it, for your clients or your customers to have it, for your family to have it, for your investors to have it. So that is the main takeaway that I at least had from my first startup.
Excellent. It seems like you've done a lot in your life. You know, what's left to achieve now, would you say?
I'm a firm believer. I'm 53 and I'm a firm believer in the 100-year life, right? I think my generation, not every one of us, and I'm not tempting fate with this, but I'm saying in general, I think with the advances in medical technology, we live to be 100. Mm-hmm. So the way I look at it is that I have 47 more years in which to do new things. And, you know, for me, life is about learning something new. When I went into analytics, like I said, it was a challenge for me, but I went ahead and said, listen, I can do this and I can learn stats and maths. And then I went into building a product for the first time. I had to learn technology, or at least understand about technology and coding and all of that. So that's been a challenge. So for me, I think the way I look at it is that there's so much more time left to do new things, mm-hmm. to learn new things and find new challenges. And I like to challenge myself once in every 3 or 4 years, either on the professional and or the personal front. Mm-hmm. So when I turned 50, I went and climbed a mountain, which was, I picked an easy one. I mean, Kilimanjaro is not particularly hard, but it's still 6,000 meters and I never climbed anything more than 20 flights of stairs to my apartment. So I'm now trying to write a book.
Okay.
And I made a commitment somewhere this year, I will try and complete this book. So that's new. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot left, Neil. I mean, you know, life ain't over at 53. Life begins. I mean, the way I look at it is these are the most interesting years of my life now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Excellent. And away from the start, so what are your hobbies and interests?
Music is perennial. Music and movies and reading are what keeps me going. I'm an avid reader. I listen to a lot of music. I love watching good movies. Mm-hmm. I play a lot of sport. I still play cricket fairly competitively and well. Mm-hmm. I think I'm very interested in public policy and more trying to understand what is going on in economics and politics and how inequality is creating a world where I think we should all be very afraid of where the world is headed. Mm-hmm. And I think we all have also an obligation to find a way to find solutions. It's not just some few politicians that have to do it or a few economists. I think all of us have a part to play in this whole solution of what is the right economic model for the world. Separately, one of the things I do love doing is mentoring, coaching, helping any budding entrepreneur in any way they want to. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because I realize it's an extremely lonely and hard journey, having been through it. Mm-hmm. So finding time to help people who are doing their own startups is something that I mean, the one thing I will prioritize over sleep is finding time to help other entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. What should first-time founders be focusing on then, in your opinion?
Well, to me, I think you've got to have a inner... So I would say there are two things, right? You've got to have some clarity, some inner voice that tells you that you are solving a problem and you should stay very, very focused on saying that problem is, one, worth solving, and two, you have a unique way to solve that problem. Far too often, you will get a lot of advice from people, whether from VCs or friends or your employees or even people like me who are supposed to mentor you, saying why it will not work. But ultimately, I think one thing that a founder should do is to have that inner voice that you can always fall back on that gives you clarity as to what problem you're solving and why you're solving it, why you think your take on that problem is unique. The second thing that I would actually urge founders to do is, I mean, I told you about keeping the faith and persistence already when I talked about the Chinese bamboo tree. But one of the things I keep telling people is that don't focus, the persistence needs to be not towards an end exit, but towards building something that can actually last. Mm-hmm. Because the moment you create something that can last, there will always be somebody who will say, I find value in it, and you'll get an exit. So it's a very funny thing. If you go seeking an exit, you're probably going to build a mediocre company because all you're thinking about is, I want to sell it to somebody who sees something in it. Let me kind of build something that they want. Mm-hmm. But if you build something that's really meant to last and can stand the test of time, you're in a funny way, you're bound to attract people who want to buy it out in some way, or you know, do an IPO or something. So your exit will actually happen when you build something to last. So I keep saying the second one is that you should have the persistence and the faith to go out and build something that will last.
Excellent. I mean, going back to the startup then, what are you working on right now then?
Oh, well, what am I working on apart from Crayon? I mean, within Crayon, we always have 20 ideas. I mean, there's already a CEO and a leadership team that are running the firm on a day-to-day basis. So I focus on innovations and you know, what's the next new thing that we should be building. And that takes a certain amount of my time. So, for example, we're building this AI taste bot, as we call it, that really seeks to understand people's tastes and dining and then finds out exactly what's right for you, right down to the level of saying, if you like a particular dish, where's the best place to get that particular dish, right? So I do the new product and the evangelization of new ideas with clients inside the company. I also work with a couple of other startups which are trying to do new and exciting things in analytics. One works in the area of visual analytics, mm-hmm. which is just looking at images and trying to make sense out of them and helping brands and companies actually use that to, you know, to understand their customers better. One works in the area of creating an open source recommender system that can completely democratize analytics. It's taking what companies like SAS and SPSS and all these big companies sell for hundreds of thousands of dollars and says, I will make it available for $1,000 a month to any enterprise that wants them, or even less. Mm-hmm. So I'm working with a couple of young startups that are doing interesting things in analytics. So that's what I do on the professional side. Personally, I told you I'm writing a book, and I decided not to write a business book, but to stretch myself and write a book on fiction. So okay. that's hard. I mean, it's mm-hmm. it's a different, completely different mindset. I mean,
how's that going?
Started very well. Wrote the first three chapters, got the title, have the plot, have the characters. But finding time to sit down and write, because, you know, you need to create space around yourself to get into the mood of the character, write that thing without being distracted by your day-to-day concerns. So I probably need to take a couple of weeks off and sit in a quiet resort somewhere or in a quiet place and you know, find windows like that where I can sit and write, you know, a few chapters at a time. But I'm quite excited about it. I mean, if I can pull it off, I think it'll be quite a, you know, I mean, I would say this, but I think it's going to be an interesting book.
What's the title then?
The working title is Love in the Time of Algorithms.
Okay.
It's about, well, you know, you can make out from the title. It's about a graph that can actually predict love. So, interestingly. So, you know, but it's fiction. It's pure fiction. It's fantasy.
Excellent.
I mean, you know, hopefully it'll solve this idea of finding a perfect mate. I mean, or it's a story about finding that person.
Cool.
Which, of course, as you know, doesn't exist in the world.
Yeah, cool. Last few questions then. I mean, do you have like heroes, like business heroes?
There's the usual suspects that always inspire you, right? And, you know, most of them come from the non-business world. And perhaps because I grew up in India, I've been reading about Gandhi or the Dalai Lama. Mandela was always part of this whole thing. But again, it's not about them just for what they did. But I think for me, it's the personal struggle that each of them went through that really is the is why I admire them. Each of them had their own demons to conquer. Mm-hmm. Each of them had their own. So it's not about whether, you know, you achieve freedom or independence or the political struggle that they did, but the inner demons that they had to fight and how they actually had to carry people along. Which really interests me in them. And to me, that's a, they're also my fallback, if you will, when I'm in times of trouble. Mm-hmm. Like I said, you know, I just go back and I look at them and I say, you know, compared to what they had to go through, this is nothing. On the business side, I mean, again, I like people who are basically bold enough to tell the world that, you know, hey, you don't know what's possible and I'm going to go and do it. And, I guess, therefore, you know, again, you'll pick all the normal names, you'll pick Steve Jobs and Elon Musk and people like that who are bold enough to say, I'm going to try something that ain't been tried. But, you know, I think I think these are heroes, not in a iconic sense of, you know, I want to be like them or emulate them, but I think I just want to look at what did they go through and what is in their mind. And when I look at what is in their mind, I think that's when you really learn something from their story, right? I mean, you learn how you can go through failure. And one of the biggest things that I take away from all of the names I mentioned, and certainly Musk is not in that yet because I don't think he's seen enough failure, but with all the others is what happens when you see failure and how do you react to it? And I go back and look at their lives for saying, how do they react to failure? And the second thing that I really kind of take away from them is how can you be bold enough to step away from the crowd, including the crowd that you've been with all your life, and say, I have to do something differently and I'm going to have the courage to do that differently. Mm-hmm. And if you read Long Walk to Freedom, when Nelson Mandela comes out of jail, he says that everybody else, and even in his closest colleagues, wanted to take a certain path, but he realized he had to step away and take a different path if he wanted to actually achieve what he wanted. And so to me, that those two learnings are really what I take away from those heroes, more than, you know, the fact that they are heroes and they are, like, you know, revered around the world. For me, it's about, I think that again is a very entrepreneurial instinct, right? Mm-hmm. It's not what happens when you fail, but it's how you kind of learn from that failure and how you come back. And it's about how you're bold enough to say, I'm not going to walk that beaten path. I'm going to do something. I'm going to go some other way and, you know, I'm going to prove that that's right.
Mm-hmm. It seems that you've had a long entrepreneurial journey. Anything that surprised you?
So, obviously, I think one of the things that has happened, Neil, which is a strange revelation to me, is how comfortable I am with the uncertainty and with the stress and the pains of entrepreneurship. It obviously helps that, you know, I've been successful once and therefore I feel I can do it again. But even in the first round, I somehow felt comfortable being an entrepreneur, being slightly different. And so it was very strange to me because I didn't know I would be that way when I set out. I had obviously all the fears and the worries about being an entrepreneur. But here's a funny thing that happened, you know, and this is strange. I was stepping away from an extremely successful corporate career, and everyone was telling me, why are you doing it? And the first 2 years didn't go well. And I was like, no money to pay the bills and all the usual stories like credit card debt, all of that stuff. And one thing I realized then, which I should have known all along, but this is strange. And I think pleasantly strange, if you will, was that I realized my friends would still be my friends. And the people who loved me would still love me. And it wasn't about what I achieved. It wasn't about what I did or what job I held. It wasn't my title on the card that they were relating to. It was actually me as a person. And the fact that I was open, I shared my struggles with them, and they were there to support me. And that was a moment of liberation, if you will. And my biggest advice that I give anybody is, you're not your title. You know, all of the people who sit inside large companies and who say, oh, I've achieved this title. It is not the title. It is who you are that actually liberates you, finding yourself. So to me, that all my friends helped me find out that, hey, this is the person I am. And, you know, and you know, we love you as the person you are. We don't need you to be successful. They loved me when I hadn't sold Red Pill to IBM. And they love me the same, I mean, after I've sold it as well.
Excellent. So last question then. For people who want more information on Crayon Data and yourself, what do they need to do?
So Crayon Data is quite easy. It's www.crayondata.com, or you can look us up on either Facebook or LinkedIn. I think we're on both of them. As for me, if somebody wants to write to me, I try and respond to every email I can get. I can't always guarantee it, but my email ID is suresh@crayondata.com. On LinkedIn, I am Suresh Shankar. I'm easily traceable. And I think if people do want to reach out, just so that they don't, just to ensure that I don't miss out, they should just support your show and say, I heard about it on the show, and I will try and respond to
that. Excellent. Suresh, thank you for coming on the show today. I much appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Neil. It's been great talking to you as well. And I look forward to hearing what my first podcast will sound like on the air.
Excellent. Thank you, Suresh. Thanks to Suresh for coming on the show today. That's the end of the show. If you liked it, please leave a rating and review of the show. Just search for the Indian Startup Show on iTunes. We're also on Stitcher and Overcast, Pocket Casts, Downcast, Instacast, Podkicker, and Apple TV. If you're building something exciting, please send me an email, hello@neilpatel.co, or tweet @IndianStartupShowSH, or go to facebook.com/IndianStartupShow. I would love to connect. Thank you and goodbye.